ankle properly. Just don't drop me, Pancho growled. The ground is very stony, very uneven. We're doing the best we can. Just don't drop me, she repeated. They only dropped her once.
When the Cellini emergency team brought Fuchs, his three crew, and the Humphreys security people to the hospital, Fuchs had the presence of mind to give his name as Carl Menstein. Medical personnel put each survivor of the fire into a gurney and wheeled them to beds separated by plastic curtains. Fuchs knew he had to get out of the hospital as quickly as possible with his crew. He lay on the crisp white sheets, staring at the cream-colored ceiling, wondering how far away from him the others were. Nodan's wounded, he remembered. That's going to make an escape more difficult. It's only a matter of time before they realize Manstein is an alias, a fiction. Then what? But a new thought struck him, and suddenly he smiled up at the ceiling, alone in his curtained cubicle. When he and the Humphreys security chief finally staggered through the hatch and the temporary airlock that the Cellini emergency crew had erected, the head of the emergency team had asked him, "Anybody else in there?" The security chief had shaken his head gravely. "Nobody alive," he had said.
"Humphreys is dead!"
Fuchs exulted. Lying on his hospital bed, his eyes still stinging and his lungs raw from the smoke, he wanted to laugh with glee.
"I did it! I killed the murdering swine! Martin Humphreys is dead!"
Martin Humphreys was quite alive, but gnawingly hungry. He had never in his life known hunger before, but as he paced, or sat, or stretched out on the thick carpeting of his closet hideaway, his empty stomach growled at him. It hurt, this hollow feeling in his belly. It stretched the minutes and hours and drove his mind into an endless need for food. Even when he tried to sleep, his dreams were filled with steaming banquets that he somehow could not reach. Thirst was even worse. His throat grew dry, his tongue seemed to get thicker in his mouth, his eyes felt gritty. "I could die in here," he realized. 100 times he went to the airtight panel, touched it gingerly with his fingertips. It felt cool. He pressed both hands on it, flattened his cheek against it. "Fire must be out by now," he thought. His wristwatch told him that more than 20 hours had gone by. The fire's got to be out by now. But what about the air? Is there any air to breathe on the other side of the panel? "Somebody will come," he assured himself. "My security chief knows about this shelter. If he wasn't killed in the fire, if he didn't suffocate from lack of oxygen, Farrar. Victoria might have gotten out. She'll tell them I'm here." But then he wondered, will she? I wouldn't let her in here with me. She could be sore enough to let me rot in here, even if she got out okay. But even so, somebody will send people to go through the house, assess the damage. The Cellini safety inspectors. The goddamn insurance people will be here sooner or later. "Later," a sardonic voice in his mind told him. "Don't expect the insurance adjusters to break their butts getting here." "It's all that motherless architect's fault," Humphreys fumed. "Idiot! Builds this emergency shelter without a phone to make contact with the outside. Without sensors to tell me if there's air on the other side of the door. I'll see to it that he never gets another commission. Never. He'll be panhandling on street corners by the time I get finished with him. There's not even a water fountain in here. I could die of thirst before anybody finds me." He slumped to the floor and wanted to cry, but his body was too dehydrated to produce tears.
Ballistic rocket. From her seat by the narrow window, Pancho could see out of the corner of her eye the rugged lunar highlands gliding swiftly past, far below. She was the only passenger on the ballistic rocket, as it arced high above the moon's barren surface, carrying her from Astro's Malapert base back to Cellini. Her ankle was set in a spray cast. She was heading for Salini's hospital and injections of nanomachines that would mend her broken bones and repair the damage that radiation had done to her body. Pancho had precious little time to study the scenery. She was deep in conversation with Jake Wanamaker, whose craggy, unsmiling face reminded her of the rocky land below. "Should be releasing the nanomachines right about now," Wanamaker was saying. "And everybody on Vesta is below ground?" Pancho asked. "Ought to be, with that radiation cloud sweeping over them. Anybody on the surface is going to be dead no matter what we do." Pancho nodded. "All right. Now what's this about Humphrey's mansion burning down?" Wanamaker grimaced with distaste. "A group of four fanatics infiltrated into the grotto down there on the bottom level. Why? We don't know yet. They're being held by Salini security in the hospital."
"And they burned the house down?"
"Set the whole garden on fire. The place is a blackened wasteland."
"Humphreys?"
"No sign of him. Salini inspectors are going through the place now. Apparently the house is still standing, but it's been gutted by the fire."
Strangely, Pancho felt no elation at the possibility that Humphreys was dead. "Have they found his body?"
"Not yet."
"And the people who attacked the place are in the hospital?"
"Under guard."
Pancho knew only one person in the entire solar system who would be crazy enough to attack Humphreys in his own home, Lars Fuchs. Was Lars Fuchs one of the attackers? Wanamaker's acid expression deepened into a dark scowl. "He gave his name as Carl Manstein. I don't think Salini's security has tumbled to who he really is."
For an instant, Pancho wondered how Wanamaker knew that Manstein was an alias for Fuchs. But she put that aside as unimportant.
"Get him out of there," she said.
"What?"
"Get him out of the hospital. Out of Salini. Send him back to the Belt, to Ceres, anywhere. Just get him loose from Salini's security."
"But he's a murderer, a terrorist.
I brought him to Salini to help in our fight against Humphreys," Pancho half lied. "I don't want Stavanger or anybody else to know that."
"How am I supposed to get him past Salini's security guards?" Wanamaker asked, clearly distressed.
Pancho closed her eyes for a moment. Then,
"Jake, that's your problem. Figure it out. I want him off the moon and headed back to the Belt yesterday."
He took a deep breath, then replied reluctantly,
"Yes, ma'am."
For an instant, she thought he was going to give her a military salute.
"Anything else?" Pancho asked. Wanamaker made a face that was halfway between a smile and a grimace. "Isn't that enough?"
Ulysses S. Quinlan felt awed, his emerald green eyes wide with admiration, as he stood in the middle of the huge downstairs living room of the Humphreys mansion, or what was left of it. The wide, spacious room was a charred and blackened desolation, walls and ceiling scorched, floor littered with burned stumps of debris and powdery gray ash. Born in Belfast of an Irish father and Irish-American mother, Quinlan had grown up to tales of civil wars. To please his father, he played football from childhood, which eventually brought him an athletic scholarship to Princeton University back in the States, which pleased his mother, even though she cried to be separated from her only child. Quinlan studied engineering and worked long years on the frustrating and ultimately pointless seawalls and hydromechanical barriers that failed to prevent the rising ocean from flooding out most of Florida and the Gulf Coast regions as far south as Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. He suffered a nervous breakdown when Houston was inundated and was retired at full pension precisely on his 40th birthday. To get away from oceans and seas and floods, he retired to the moon. Within a year, he was working in Salini's safety department, as happy and cheerful as he'd been before the disastrous greenhouse floods on Earth. Now he whistled through his breathing mask as he goggled at the size of the mansion's living room. "The grandeur of it all," he said as he shuffled through the gray ash and debris. "Like the old Tsars in Russia," said his partner, a stocky, red-headed Finnish woman. He could hear the contempt in her tone.